This interview with Donald Braxton was recorded on June 5th, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
I've been home almost a month and a half right now, and I can't put the words together to express how I feel being home. There's no two words to express how I feel, you know. And I really feel as though that I was given a sense of community for a reason. Not knowing if you're ever going to see the outside of society again each day for 365 days a year is like a burden that you carry every day. Knowing one thing in the morning that you hate every minute of the day, you hate everybody around you, and it's that no one's done nothing to you, but that's the way you feel because you're surrounded by so much negativism on a constant basis. Basically, I moved around from the Jessup region to the Hagerstown region and back to the Jessup region. That's where I was released from, the Jessup region. I mean, I used to just find myself sitting around wondering would I ever be able to hug my mother again. I wasn't fortunate enough to make it out before my father passed away. And that blessing, I just kept praying that one day I'll be able to hug my mother without a barrier being around me or having somebody to tell me, back up, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it's really, I mean, that's what really kept me going. And then when a young lady came to me and said, Braxton, one of your dreams is get ready to come true. I thought she was joking. And I said, well, y'all know you wouldn't joke with a situation like that. And it was like overwhelming, you know. I went in 1981. At the age of 16, for a first-degree murder. The night of the murder, it was like four or five of us, and our intent was to make some fast money, whatever means necessary, but it was never our intent to harm anyone, but in the process, things went astray, and as a direct result, the individual lost his life. About five or six of us was on the basketball court, and we came together that we was going to go make some fast money to get some weed, marijuana, and some beer, and we went out with the intent to rob somebody. Never was it an intent to harm anyone, but in the process, a person lost his life. If I went with my better judgment, I would have never been in that situation, because when you get ready to do something, you get anxiety bubbles in your stomach, and that's telling you that you get ready to do something that you shouldn't do. And my self-conscious kept telling me, leave the playground. But I paid no attention to it. And I've come to learn every time I go against my better judgment, it comes back to haunt me. And I really came to grip with the pain and suffering that I caused the victim family when my father died, you see what I'm saying? Because it was a situation where as though when you go to prison, you don't go to prison by yourself. You take your family. And my family didn't ask for that. My family, ordinary citizen taxpayers trying to make a daily living. And I caused them a lot of trauma. If you want to hear some wild stories, Stan, that's not my story. I came from a two-parent household in the house. Mm-hmm. In the house, it was no sir, yes sir. When out on the street, it was be accepted by your peers, not accepting who I was, but I wanted to be accepted by them. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. I grew up at a recreation center playing basketball. My brother played for the late Dunbar. I went to Carver. Our family is a sports-orientated family. Wasn't a whole lot of hanging out, getting in trouble with the law, this, that, and other. I was scared, sending a 16-year-old kid to a place where he know no one, know nothing about it. And the first thing they tell you, survive at your own cost. Couldn't go to the police and say, so-and-so leaning on me. If you ever have a problem you was confronted with, you had to stand up and be accounted for. The first night that I was in there, they put us in like a dormitory situation. What I mean by dormitory, just bunks, there's no cells. And you might have 40 or 50 guys in a dormitory. And I wasn't in there 8 hours, and the guy got killed about an AM/FM radio. So I'm tripping. So when they finally let us out to get on the phone, I breaks down and call my people. I say, hey, y'all didn't tell me they kill people in here. And I'm tripping. And then things that you couldn't conceive in your mind, we were seeing on a daily basis. I could tell you some stories that you say, oh, no, he lying. But it's the honest truth preyed on you. Coming in, like I said, at the age of 16, every week I was either cussing one of them out or challenging them to the fact that they was only doing their job, but I thought they was trying to chump me. I used to tell them all the time, now you talk to me worse than my parents talk to me. I'm not having that. And for the first 5 years, I went on and off lockup, on and off lockup. And then I came to realize, while I'm going on lockup, they going home at 4 o'clock. And I was the one losing out. So when I came off, the last time I went on lockup, an old guy pulled me up. He said, man, don't think you're going to keep running around going on lockup and playing basketball and don't do nothing in here. He made me go to school. When I went to school, I got my GED. And then it seemed like when I got my GED, I wasn't satisfied. I kept progressing more. And I ended up earning like 74 credits from Cotton State University. And I received an AA degree from Essex Community College. And then I started tutoring other younger guys and letting them know that there's other ways than what we were doing, constantly going on lockup. But you would do anything to escape reality in there. The white man ain't did nothing. We did it to ourselves. So I had to really, really take responsibility. And in order for my growth to keep growing as it is now, I got to share my story with somebody else, hoping that they don't travel the road that I travel. Did that. So I didn't take heed right then and there, because when dudes give you advice, it's always all kinds of good. I'm looking at them like, man, what's up with this guy? And a few other dudes verified that he was a good dude, that you could listen to him, you could sit down and talk to him, because he had been around a while. You know, so you just don't jump at ever who extend their hand to help you. You pay close attention to who's extending that hand. I would consider myself the man after I survived the first day, but I wasn't a mature man. Because if anybody can go in there and survive, I tip my hat to them. Being a man, anybody can say they're a man, but it takes a person to actually demonstrate the degree to be a real man. A real man make right decisions, you know what I mean, and things of that nature. Straight to the Maryland State Penitentiary on Fall Street. Now, my personal feelings on that, I feel as though if you come in at a young age, you shouldn't go straight to the penitentiary. I think they should send them to Hagerstown. The reason I say send them to Hagerstown, because up there, they're going to make you grow up. You got to follow rules and regulations. It's not wide open like OK Corral. They're going to make you go to school. They pay you to go to school. They're going to make you have discipline within yourself. Because why I say that is because, excuse my friends, in the pen, you might have brothers call them sisters, bees, this, that, and other, not realizing that that's somebody's mother or sister trying to make a living. Up Hagerstown, I don't know if it's because we're afraid of the white people. It's no sir, yes sir. My thing of thought is, how can you call the Caucasian lady, ma'am, miss, but you call your own person who got the same color of your skin, bees and whores? And I don't understand that. So I think each youth that come through the system should go to Hagerstown first to get that discipline. Well, before I went in, you didn't have that many boarded up houses. You had your junkies out on the corner. But right now, I take all that and being in a cell with somebody. So it's beautiful to me, even though that may sound crazy. I'm just so happy to be free. I get to hug my mother every day. I get to tell her I love her every day. And that was something that was taken, well, that was something that I denied myself of because of that one decision. The block was always clean. How can you live around trash? If you live around trash, you must be trash. You know what I mean? But it's beautiful to me. But I don't have no problem get the stick and put the picnic trash up, put it in the bag. It's like overwhelming. I got to meet nephews that I never met before. And there's still things that I still haven't experienced. Well, I try to stay busy as much as possible. I joined several different organizations, as far as like Project Turnaround, which was a group that tried to deter youth from coming to prison. I played sports. I talked on the phone. Each day I tried to switch my program up. I found myself hanging with guys that was trying to do the right thing. Just because we was in a negative situation, that don't mean we had to be negative. So I tried to hang with them guys because I know eventually the blessings that they was receiving, that their cup would overflow, and I wanted to be that saucer to catch the blessings that they let go. And that's what kept me going. And to know that I had a unique people behind me still loving me and encouraging me to hold on. Don't give up. Don't hold on. Because there have been many days I was like, man, I'm tired of this. I ain't going to do this no more. But there's always the power above me to push me on. Go on. Hold on. There's a reason for it. Just hold on. And when April the 15th came, I was like a newborn baby. I may have had about four or five different lawyers working to get me out. And when my father passed away, I said I couldn't ask my mother for any more money because she was by herself. One of my co-defendants came home about 5 years ago, and I told my mother, I said, so-and-so getting out. And her words were, well, you coming home too. I ain't going to let you stay in there. You coming home too. And I don't know how she did it or what she did, but she came up with the money for the lawyer. And the lawyer went at the integrity unit of Merle Mosby and Becky Feldman. And Merle Mosby more or less said, I was the prime case that she was looking for. How I was too young to vote, but I could serve 40 years in prison. And she immediately recommended that I would be released. Yeah, I regretted making that wrong decision. And when the judge said life, my knees down there buckled because during the process of before we went to trial, I came out on $100,000 bail. When I came out on bail, I stayed out for 8 days and they revoked the bail. But I kept saying to myself, this thing is serious. They don't even want me out on bail, so this thing is serious. It was a long process, but it also was a learning process. That's where I met Earl Young and a couple other guys, maybe about 3 or 4 years into being in the prison. We formed a youth group, but the youth group was just paperwork. We was taking rolling heels for anybody to mess with any young. Wasn't having it. So that's how we survived. Then they once they seen that we wasn't going for nothing, everything, I would say, ran smoothly, but it was easier than what it could have been. See, back then they played so many mind games. So you might be carrying your box coming through the yard, and a brother might say, oh, brother Stanley, ain't it? Oh, yeah. No. I don't know Stanley, and he could be a legit friend of your brother, even though you don't know him, you don't know the motive of his actions, you tell him no. Because I had a friend who used to pull me up and say, man, I know your father. Your father used to quarterback the Midwest. Your father used to play for the Rams. I said, no, that's not my father. One old dude pulled me up and said, man, you ain't got to act like that. We know Braxton, your father. I know you. He said, man, I went to Douglas High School with your father and your mother. And I was like, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, my last name is Braxton, but I don't know them. But all the time, it was my defensive mechanism, not letting him thinking that he got an inside trail to get close to me. So you don't have friends or open yourself up to guys when you first go in there. It take a while to get adjusted. And then you start, yeah, man, I so-and-so. I used to come and get on the phone all the time. Man, so-and-so say he went to school with you, or he played ball with you when you played with the Baltimore Rams, this, that, and other. You know?
Yeah.
So you got to be real careful about that. 4 decades robbed me of not knowing what my future really could have been. And, you know, I had a dream like everybody else. I thought I could play basketball, play football, when I wanted to have a family. And then, I mean, it's the same elbows, dudes fighting, things of that nature. But you would be surprised how organized the sports were. They took the sports very serious in there. And then when it came like playoff time, Mr. Wade, who's the coach Dunbar, his sons and them used to come in and call the playoff games for us. And so they take the sports in there very seriously. The one thing I was excited for, I could grab my mother and tell her I loved her. That was the first thing. It was a few members of my family on the porch waiting for me to come home. But the first thing I wanted to do was embrace my mother with no barriers. When she made the statement that she made, it gave me more hope to hold on. And then when she told me, I got the lawyer for you, that like opened my mind up to even broader things. I started thinking, oh, well, this might happen. But the lawyer who she hired was a good lawyer, but he was taking forever. My mother kept saying, did this lawyer take my money and go to the Bahamas? What's going on? Like a five-year process. And then when Ms. Waters came to see me, it was like 5,000-pound weight was taken off my shoulder. I was like, man, they tell me I'm going home. So when you get news of that magnitude in a situation that's that, you got to be careful who you share it with. Because some dudes know there's no light at the end of the tunnel for them, so they'll do anything to hinder you from moving forward. So I had to be very careful and select who I shared my news with. You'd be surprised, Stan, at what they would do. I felt like a little baby not knowing anything. So I'm fortunate that I got a couple of young nephews that have been showing me the way, bringing me up to date with what's going on. I mean, it's mind-boggling how advanced technology has come from when I was out here to right now. I have a few brothers that are associated with different organizations that deal with the kids. Like I told a couple of my friends, I'm not coming out trying to be the police because that's not my MO. My MO is to try to share with at-risk youth or youth that's at that fork in the road that need just a little push in the right way and to share my story with them. So in some kind of capacity, I'm going to be working with kids. And the dude actually took a butcher knife and cut himself a new anus. He said the anus that God gave him was no longer working properly, so he took the knife and cut himself a new anus. That's one story. And maybe about 3 weeks later, we had a brother take an ink pen and actually pull his eyeball out. I mean, things that you can't conceive in your mind happens in there on a normal basis. I mean, stories that would blow your mind. Guys losing their life for a bar of soap or because his girl didn't push one to accept his call, so he stabs him 40, 50 times. I mean, a whole bunch of wild stories. And I was like, blown away. I mean, I should have like a few of my friends look like Jason or Friday. I mean, you had to actually be there to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it happened on a daily basis. I don't want to be judgmental and say the wrong thing. I don't know. I just pray that I was strong enough that I didn't go through experiences like that. I would pray that every day be a different day and that I would get stronger, because everybody's weakness made me that much stronger to succeed. And I mean, it was some crazy stuff in that. I don't call people friends no more. I have, what I've done since being incarcerated, I draw the circle around me. And only the people that penetrate that circle are what I call friends. And while I was inside, I had one brother that we grew up together, and he was my friend the whole 40 years. He brought his sons to the family affairs. He let me be a part of his family, and we stayed close. And when the day I got released from prison, who's sitting on the parking lot other than my real friend? You know what I mean? And I salute him for that. So you have visits, you get phone calls, you know, and you can internet with people if they really concerned about you. In prison, no one was my friend. I had, again, associates. You know what I mean? I had one dude, I know if I got in a situation, he would watch my back and I would watch his back. But say friend, that's something that I hold close to my chest.